Welcome to Come Inside.
Today's guest is Dr. Xanthi Mallett. She's a forensic anthropologist, a criminologist, a TV presenter, an author, and she teaches at the University of Newcastle. As a criminology student myself, being given the chance to speak to someone who is so respected in their fields was pretty cool, really. Unfortunately, I did have some technical issues whilst editing this episode, and the last 20 minutes of our chat was wiped out. So it might feel like the conversation stops abruptly, and that would be why. So that's, you know, lesson learned on my behalf, but that's okay. And I'm sure one day in the future, I'll get another chance to speak to Xanthi and we can kind of touch on those things again. Before you listen to the episode, I just want to let you know that Dr. Xanthi Mallett has an amazing book. It's called Mothers Who Murder, and it's brilliant. And I'll put a link in the description of the episode if you do want to buy that book, because I found it a really interesting read. I really liked my conversation with Xanthi. You can tell that she has really strong morals and values, which is amazing, especially in the criminal justice field, because her concern is, did this person get a fair trial? Here it is. Enjoy. I wanted to start off asking you if there was anything in your childhood that is directly linked with what you do now. I know you're a criminologist, but you're also an anthropologist.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Anthropologist, that's correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
Your mum was a dancer, dad's the engineer. So you had really both worlds.
Weird hybrid. Yeah. So there's nothing really in my childhood that led me specifically to be interested in what I'm interested in now. When I went to university, I was interested in all of the courses that studied bones and human evolution, that kind of thing. I did an archaeological science degree as my undergrad. And I realised then that if I was going to work in that area, I wanted to do something that had a practical utility that would help people now. So I think that's why I went down that kind of forensic route, because obviously if you're looking at human remains to help identify them and they're contemporary, then even if it doesn't have a criminal element in terms of the individual may have died of natural causes, however, if they're unidentified, then you can learn a lot from the remains.
Okay.
So it had to have some type of utility where it's going to benefit people, either the victim by helping to get their name reinstated or by returning them to their family. At least they get closure. I hate that word, but closure. And then as I was working within forensics, I became more interested in the behaviour patterns that lead to crime scenes and the reasons people commit the crimes they do. And so that's why I kind of moved into criminology as well. So it's more of an evolution of interests, as opposed to looking back and going, oh, there was that one thing that made me really want to study crime. It was just, I really love watching people. And I guess crime represents the extremes of what people will do to each other, you know, when they're really pushed to breaking point or are really, you know, really self-interested in some of the kind of white collar crimes. So that's what really kind of engendered my interest, I guess.
Do you think everyone has that ability to be pushed to breaking point and commit, I don't know, murder, for example?
I think probably most people have it in them if the circumstances are correct. I mean, certainly I would say if somebody was threatening my family or I was in an emergency situation where you're there with somebody violent and, you know, this is about self-protection or protecting somebody else, then I think anyone in that moment or a lot of people in that moment can be pushed, because our survival instinct is so developed that for a lot of people, you would do whatever you would have to do to survive. Not everybody, some people freeze. But if you can't freeze, you know, and that's not going to help, and you can't run, you know, and fight is your only option left, then I think a lot of people could be pushed to it given the correct circumstances without any evil or, you know, kind of malintent. It's just about survival at that moment.
Yeah, okay. Do you ever look at, I know sometimes I look at cases where maybe mums have killed their baby, for example, and I think, even though I think that's horrible, a part of me goes, yeah, you know what, I could actually maybe see how they got to that point. Like, maybe they lack support. I mean, it's hard to generalize and I don't want to do that. I'm not saying this for all cases, and I certainly don't condone killing their child. I can kind of see how they could maybe be pushed
that yeah, far where they feel like, oh my God, there's no way out, and they just start kind of shaking a baby or something, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh no, what did I do?
Yeah. You're talking about basically a psychological break of some description where people are maybe suffering postnatal depression or postnatal psychosis.
Yeah, and more than being evil.
Yeah, exactly. There's no premeditated intent. It's a lack of coping. And in those situations, and that happens fairly frequently when children are harmed, especially by their mothers, it's a case of lack of support, lack of education. You know, they don't have this family network, partners. They're overwhelmed by the situation. So there's no intent to harm the child. It's just that moment of madness, I guess. Yeah. And that does happen. But you do get, on the flip side, parents, including mothers, who intentionally harm their children.
Absolutely.
As an act of revenge or because the child is inconvenient to their lifestyle. You know, and I've written about this. And so that, I think, is always more shocking when you realize that somebody has intentfully decided to rid themselves of a child. And I know what you mean by you can just see somebody getting to that breaking point where they just lose it just for a second. And with a child, that's all it takes, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I think the way we view these cases, we have to be really careful that we're not just labeling everyone as evil, because I think that's really an easy thing to do, but it's not looking at the causes of these crimes and why do some women feel that they have no support, especially if they're from a particular community. So an immigrant community, for example, if they don't have anyone from their community, they don't maybe speak the same language as those around them, and they just become very isolated without family.
Yeah.
So I think looking at those social networks that can support people to prevent some of these crimes happening is much more positive than simply labeling everyone because we feel so deeply uncomfortable with the crime itself.
Yeah, which I think that's what we do as society, unfortunately. Oh, we just label everyone and we put them all in their box, and that's just what you are. Like, you're evil, you're this, you're that.
Yeah, that makes us more comfortable, I think, because
if
we go, okay, well, those horrible things have happened to somebody else and they were done by somebody else, a different kind of person. It's not my neighbours, it's not my family. It's what we would call in criminology othering. You're kind of separating yourself psychologically and emotionally from them because that's easier to deal with rather than looking at the causative factors behind some of these events.
Yep. Okay. Have you seen things in common when you look at certain cases? Like inmates, criminals, or like murderers or something? Do they? It's so hard to generalize, but it's just a question. I really like to know if there's something you've noticed. You know, upbringing, abuse, this, that, the other.
It depends completely on the crime. So I think, as I said, you know, a lot of people can be pushed to committing really serious, violent crimes. But with a lot of the premeditated crimes I've looked at, I'm just writing a true crime book, actually. And as I was reviewing all of the cases at the end, the majority of cases in there are males as the violent perpetrator. There is a case where there's a female, but it's a different type of case, and I'll explain in a moment. But the males who are repeat serial predatory offenders, either sex offenders or murderers, so I'm talking the Ivan Milats of this world, then those type of men, and Daniel Holden, who I've included a chapter on him, who has been found guilty of murdering Carly Pierce Stevenson, the young woman whose body was in Belangolo, and her toddler, Candelise Pierce. Those type of individuals, I do think there is a type, you know, and almost you can kind of pick them. So they're at the extreme levels of the individuals who lack empathy, who will do whatever they want to do because it's all about gratification, normally sexual gratification in those two cases. So there are patterns there, but they're at the extreme end, you know.
Yeah.
And the female I've included is actually a woman who's been found, she's been acquitted of murder, but she was charged and found guilty prior to her acquittal of murdering her husband. And I think in that kind of scenario, and again, I'm being very careful because she's been acquitted, so she is not guilty of any crime.
This wouldn't be Donna Facilis, would it?
It would be Donna Facilis. However, if she were guilty, and I'm not saying she is, then that's a completely different type of crime. It's not predatory. It's not premeditated. You're talking that moment of weakness where you can see somebody literally losing their temper. And so even though there was a case of a woman in that book with a male as a victim, it was a very different kind of case. So, within looking at all of those, and I hadn't chosen them, because they had anything in common. But when I looked at serial violent offenders, they were men and they were predatory and they were, you know, out on the hunt, you know, and there were certain, they came from different backgrounds. Some come from quite damaged, dysfunctional backgrounds like Malat. Daniel Holdham has got a challenged background as well. Some of it, I think, has been exaggerated possibly when he's done various statements to psychologists, etc. But certainly he has had a difficult upbringing. But, you know, a lot of other cases, there doesn't seem to be a pattern. If you look at domestic violence, that's more about that relationship between those individuals. And every week we're seeing another woman killed by a partner or largely ex-partner, you know. And in those cases, there doesn't seem to be a pattern between the offenders other than the way they end up behaving towards their partner. You know, those behaviors, controlling, manipulative behaviors. But in terms of the demographics of the actual offenders, it's so varied.
And often I find when we think about a psychopath, everyone thinks male.
Yeah.
But there are women psychopaths out there. Obviously, there are more, I think maybe men are committing more heinous crimes, or maybe they're just not getting away with it. Maybe women are getting away with it. I don't know. But there are like women out there that are psychopaths as well.
There are. But I think the research is beginning to suggest that female psychopaths have some different tendencies to males. Okay. So rather than being all out violent, they tend to be more manipulative, more abusive psychologically, especially in interpersonal relationships. So yes, there are female psychopaths, but they don't tend to start showing their tendencies to kind of their teens. And some of them can be violent, but it's not the predominant way that they get what they want. So I think a lot of the time female psychopaths are almost sliding under the radar because they're not the violent offenders that we're seeing. They're manipulating and controlling and bullying people in different ways, and they're not being labeled as psychopaths in the same way that men are, because a man's response and presentation is different to women.
Yeah, and do you think that society often will view a psychopath as someone who's extremely violent and just aggressive and everything? They don't actually look at, oh, okay, they can manipulate, they can do all these other things.
Psychopaths, they think of that extreme end of the scale, you know, but a lot of them can be very charming, very charismatic, a lot of non-violent, you know, they're not necessarily married with violent tendencies, but they lack empathy fundamentally, that being one of the descriptive factors. So when they commit crimes or whatever they do, you know, throughout their life, they're doing it for their own ends, and they're very good at mimicking other behaviors, but it's all about getting what they want. And males and females are the same in that instance. The males are getting what they want in a different way to the females, but they're still manipulating and controlling other people, because it's all about self, you know, self-gratification.
Do you think there are signs, if you've got a kid when they're growing up, that we can pick out these things where we can work on it?
Males or females?
We'll start with males.
If you've got a child, I mean, a lot of kids struggle with empathy anyway, because I think we're becoming more and more self-obsessed anyway with social media. Absolutely. And it's all about self-gratification, being liked, you know. So I think we're kind of almost minimizing kind of empathy with others, because it's all about self. And I think that's problematic. But I think if you've got a child who, especially if they've got violent tendencies, if they seem to enjoy manipulating and controlling others and actually get some sort of gratification out of torturing others, either animals or people, that would be certainly warning signs for me. And as a teen, but that can happen in younger in males. As a teenage female, they're more likely to self-harm, but as a control mechanism.
So interesting.
Self-harm to get, you know, to influence other people and to get what they want. And so if you've got females who are becoming particularly manipulative, lacking empathy, enjoying controlling behaviors, they may try and isolate people within the group to bully them and belittle them and actually enjoy. You know, and I'm sure you can all think about girls like that you knew at school, but I'm thinking at the kind of extreme end of really enjoying persecuting people, you know, and isolating other people, causing trouble, you know, spreading rumours. So I'm talking at the extreme ends, but those are the kind of tendencies you'd look for more in females than males, who tend to be, you know, different in the way that they control and manipulate their social circles.
Okay. I guess looking Because when you were saying that, I was thinking back to being in high school and I like was going through this list. Go through this list in my mind of the girls and that. And I guess I always just thought that, I don't know, it was attention seeking. And I wonder if we think that, oh, maybe they're just doing it because they just want attention. They want to be center of attention. But not that they're all going to be psychopaths, but.
Not all of them, but a percentage of them will actually be really enjoying that and enjoying belittling and psychologically harming other people.
Yeah, okay. So talking about empathy, I find in general people don't know the difference between empathy and empathy.
I saw your question. For my students, the example I give them to explain is when we actually talk about mothers who intentionally harm their children. And I say, whilst I can sympathise with some of the situations these women find themselves in, I cannot empathise with them. Because I don't have children, I've never experienced that, therefore I do not have an ability to actually draw on my own experience to understand what they're going through. However, I can understand how they can have responded the way they did in that scenario and therefore sympathise with some of the issues they're going through. But I'm not empathising.
Would you have needed to be a parent to be able to empathise though?
No, I don't. Oh, I don't know. Maybe
you need to be pushed.
Yeah, maybe you need to be pushed just that far to be able to empathise with them. It's just outside my realm of experience, so I can't empathise. But, and it's like in situations where somebody, you know, just completely loses control and kills somebody by accident. You can, like in a domestic violence situation, you know, you can sympathize with how they could get to the point where they just can't cope with it anymore. However, I can't empathize.
Yeah, absolutely. I often think of the case, kind of backtracking a little bit, of Arthur Freeman, the guy who threw his daughter, Darcy Freeman, off the Westgate Bridge here.
And then the other child, they stopped him, didn't they, throwing the other child off.
Did they stop him or was he just did he just get in the car and drive off?
I think passers-by stopped him from doing that.
Yeah, okay. Originally when I heard that, I was mortified. Like, what a thing to do. But then when you start breaking it down, you wonder if, you know, like he was having, I don't know, custody battle or something was going on with their ex-wife.
Yeah,
it's not that justifies it, but I think people think, oh, no, but if I understand that or sympathise with him, then I'm justifying what he did, which we're not. We're just...
Criminology is really about, we have all these theories to help explain crime. And in the very first lecture I say to the students, what we're not doing is trying to make excuses for these activities. What we're trying to do is understand them. So, that was revenge against his ex-wife during a custody battle. He got life imprisonment with non-parole of 32 years because he threw the four-year-old off bridge. But I'm pretty sure other people then intervened to prevent him from going back and
getting
the younger one off the bridge as well. So we're not obviously making excuses, but what must his mind have been going through in those moments to understand that, to for somebody to be pushed far enough?
He threw his own daughter, a young daughter, just off the Westgate Bridge. I mean, mortified, horrible, can't even believe that. And
quite often we hear about cases like this, you know, like there was a case just last week where the ex-partner murdered his ex-girlfriend, couldn't get over the fact she was seeing somebody else, murdered her, put her in a suitcase, then drove into a tree.
Oh, that's right. Is that the dentist or dentist?
Yeah,
problematic. I wonder if he showed signs in their relationship of being
the
controlling or something.
I imagine so. I imagine even if he wasn't doing during the relationship, afterwards, clearly he's got control and jealousy issues. And it's that point when women are most vulnerable, you know, when they're moving on. And it is often women, the male in the relationship can't let go, can't get over it. And she had a new partner. And
scary.
Very, very. Yeah. And people would say to women, why don't you just leave?
Right? It's just not that easy. No. I think I was reading it can take anywhere from 7 to 11 times to leave, like a domestic abuse situation. Yeah. They find it hard. And of course they do. And it's real easy for people to sit back and go, yeah, but just leave. Like, you're being beaten, this, that.
Yeah.
But it's just not that easy. Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
it is. And unfortunately, sometimes this is the outcome. But again, yeah, what must have been going on in his mind to do that and then drive into a tree?
Yeah, the tree thing really throws me out. Even putting her body into a suitcase. Yeah, the whole thing, very odd. Because did he die or is he alive?
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
He did die.
Yeah. It was murder-suicide, okay. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
I wonder if he killed her and then he went, oh, crap.
Oops. What have I done?
Yeah. And then went, oh, well, I don't want to be in prison the rest of my life. I need to, like, I wonder if that's why he did it.
Yeah, maybe.
Did you happen to watch the surviving R. Kelly thing or Leaving Neverland?
I haven't seen it yet, but I've seen all the kind of the adverts for it. And I even spoke to I do a course on media criminology for my students and talked to them about that at 12 o'clock today, because obviously, like, he's not been found guilty of any of these crimes. He's not been charged with any of them, as far as I'm aware. There's a series out there. And I said to them, this is problematic in a legal sense.
Oh, yeah. The series is crazy. Like, it's got interviews with, like, his ex-wife and, like, bunch of different women that he met when they were really young, and it's just absolutely crazy.
How is he going to get a fair trial now?
Yeah, probably.
If he's even charged.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what's going on with that. I thought he was going to be charged. They might still be working it out. I'm not sure how they're going about that.
It's the same thing with the teacher's pet, isn't it? The podcast, you know?
It is, that's true. Although I do think that he is guilty of something. I do think that, you know, it is hard. Yeah, it is hard, but yeah.
But if you were on the jury, you've already got you've already made up your mind that he's guilty of something. You're not going to base your determination purely on what you hear in court, which is obviously the foundation of the justice system.
Which is so problematic.
Kind of not the point. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I spoke to she was a prosecutor in New York. She's been working as a legal analyst for like 25 years, and I asked her a similar question about how do you go about jury selection and how do you know that they're telling the truth, that they're not already biased? Because I asked about cases like Casey Anthony, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, you bring up that name, especially in America, I mean, everyone's got an opinion on that. How can you find – but then she got found while she was acquitted. Yeah. So there you go. But it's – yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. Yeah, it is very hard. I don't know if we should be releasing so much information about cases before they go to trial. It's kind of hard.
It can lead to judge-only trials, certainly in Australia. And if I were Chris Dawson's defence counsel, that is absolutely what I would be pushing for, because – say around 50% of people are acquitted all charges in judge only compared to 30-something% in jury trials.
Wow.
So, but then on the flip side, can he get a fair jury trial after the teacher's pet? I did a straw poll with my students today and they'd all heard of it or all seen or listened to it. So, you know, they all had an opinion, every one of them. And I asked them about Pistorius, highly publicised. One person in the room thought he didn't do it.
Really?
Opinion, yeah.
But it is very, that's complicated. That I find that case quite complicated as well, because I think, he did something. I don't think he meant to murder her. But, again, so much information out there. And it's like I've heard you talk about the Kelly Lane case, which I do not understand how she was convicted. I still don't get it.
No, nor do I.
I mean, I remember watching the documentary about her and I was like, I do not understand how she's sitting in prison. Yeah, I don't get it. I cannot get it.
And people always ask me, do I think she did it or not? And I go, well, that just isn't the point. How can you be found guilty with no evidence, no body, no witnesses and no motive? How? Yeah. Explain that to me with our justice
system. It's very odd. Yeah, people are so focused on the fact that, oh, but she had all these kids and abortions and she kept it secret. Yeah. But it's like, yeah, okay. So too many people lie and keep secrets in the world doesn't mean they're, like, murdering children.
No, there's a massive gap between lying and murdering a child and having an abortion and murdering a child. But because she did lie and she was, you know, some people would say promiscuous, then I say suddenly that means that she'd also murder a kid. And that's what the prosecution did well. They tied together the perjury charges with the murder charge, and they should have been separated because they showed tendency evidence, and they basically tried to use the perjury as tendency for murder. Now, perjury is tendency for lying, you know. Yep. What it is not is anything to do with murder.
So no, everyone's lied before, so that's why it's – Yeah, it should have been separate. Yeah, what's going on with her? Is she getting a retrial? It's not happening, is it?
We're still waiting to hear. We're still really waiting on the decision, yes.
Are you working as part of her defence team?
So I'm not working as part of a defence team. I've been working with the Innocence Initiative out of RMIT. And what I'm trying to do at the moment is keep public interest in that case, because the Attorney General gets a lot of cases across their desk, and when there's public pressure – then that can help actually progress things and get them to take notice of it. But also, if we get a retrial, then I want the jury, as we were saying, to base their decision on the evidence presented to them in the courtroom, not have that pre-existing notion of Kelly Lane, the baby killer, you know, that was all over the media. That's so right. I'm trying to balance the other side of the coin, ask the questions and say, if we're going to do this, let's do it based on the evidence available.
Yeah, I hope that something happens. I mean, some people say, oh, but she can get out in like 4 years or 5 years. But, I mean, what does that mean?
It's a long time. She's got the kid she's trying to mother, you know, meanwhile. Every day
that's true.
She's away from that child. So,
yeah, it's very sad. I don't know. Yeah, that case doesn't make sense to me. I'm not sure she should be in prison. But I guess there's a lot of cases like that, and you've probably seen a lot. Do you think?
I've seen a few, yeah.
Yeah, you think the media and, like, social media and everything and things like the teacher's pet are really good for cases like that, because it brings awareness. But, again, with the jury for a retrial, it's problematic. So I guess it's got a bit of both.
I think it's got a bit of both. I think there can be times when the media can really raise awareness. So there was a case of a guy called Scott Ostick in WA, and I was working with Channel 7 on a series called Murder Uncovered, and Michael Asher, who was the journalist who was heading that, went over and reinvestigated this murder. So Scott Ostick was found guilty of murdering his on-off girlfriend who was pregnant. But the evidence just does not stack up. It's one of the worst miscarriages of justice or potentials that I've seen, actually. Outstanding. Now, since then, the Attorney General has granted him a retrial, and the evidence that was collected for the documentary has actually been provided to the Attorney General. So he would have just languished in prison for another X number of years because nobody was interested. So in that case, directly as a result of that documentary for Channel 7, there is going to be a review of that case and the evidence. I mean, clearly there's basically the police appear, I'm going to be careful, to have changed the evidence afterwards. So there's digital images of a crime scene showing lack of evidence, and then new digital images taken afterwards where suddenly there's a cigarette packet with blood on it of the victim.
Ah, I've seen this case. Yes. And I forgot about that.
The SCS searched for the knife, and suddenly two detectives just happened to randomly come across the knife.
That's right.
Just outside on the grass. All this evidence seems to have appeared, you know, when it wasn't there before. And so to me, that is incredibly problematic. There's also another suspect. There was bloody footprints that clearly are not his, who somebody followed her outside after she'd been stabbed, and she bled to death outside. Somebody left those footprints, and they're about a size 8. So you're thinking it's probably a woman or a very small man, and he is not a size 8. Problematic. Yeah. So that case has gone back to retrial directly as a result of the media. So it swings and roundabouts, good and bad.
Yeah, I guess like most things.
Absolutely.
Do you think social media can affect the outcome of a case? I know we were talking about like the teacher's pet and podcasts and things like that. It is very problematic, I agree.
Yeah. I think social media can. If we look at the Jill Meagher case, for example, so many posts about the alleged perpetrator before he was found guilty. And, that threatened the outcome of that trial because, you know, people were posting all sorts of things. So, I do think social media can be very problematic, because look at a situation where you've got people who are giving witness evidence. They can then, you know, tweet, or other people in the jury in the trial can tweet about what's being said, and there'll be people can read it who haven't yet given evidence.
Yeah, that's a problem.
So social media from within courtrooms is problematic. Social media around guilt or innocence of high profile cases like Jill Meagher is problematic. So yeah, I do think social media can influence the outcomes of criminal trials.
Do you think, so are you against cameras in the courtroom, for example, like they do in America?
I'm not against it per se, because I do think the flip side of that is transparency.
Yeah.
So, but I think we just have to be really careful going forward, because everyone does have mobiles, everyone's got computers. How we maintain the objectivity of the justice process is something I think that courts around the world are struggling with at the moment. How do we actually manage the situation when there are so many mechanisms for distribution of information? But I do think we need transparency. Everyone has to see not only that the justice system is, you know, fair, but that it's seen to be fair.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, it's that double-edged sword.
It is, yeah. It's really hard to figure out how we can make this work, because it's always going to be a bit of this.
Yeah.
In the UK, do they do that? Do they have cameras in the courtroom in the UK?
I'm not sure, actually. I don't think so.
Well, here we don't do it, obviously. But, I mean, in America, my God, they've got, like, networks dedicated to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, civil cases as well as criminal cases. Can't think of a single UK case where it's been televised. So I don't think we do, no.
Yeah, okay. Do you think that will change?
I don't know. We're pretty sticklers for tradition in the UK. I can't see it changing anytime soon. I mean, there is a lot of public interest in some of these really high-profile cases, but they also want to protect the process. So, I mean, I can't see it at the moment. I can't see Australia doing it at the moment either.
No.
I think we're too cautious, and I think that caution is warranted given, you know, the interest in some of these cases. You know, Pistorius was one, but the world watched it. Did that improve the justice system? I don't know. Everyone's got an opinion.
Yeah, probably not. Yeah, it's very theatrical in America.
Yes. Yeah.
So and it seems a bit more entertaining.
Yeah. We're trying to avoid making criminal trials infotainment, basically.
Yeah, which is probably a good thing, I would say. Yeah. Thanks for listening. So until next time, be the change the world needs. But for now, school's out, class dismissed.